This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're here on Saturdays talking about the disease of addiction and the road to recovery. Yeah, most of the news overwhelmingly about the disease of addiction is bad. It's a horrible disease decimating lives. But the truth is lots of people find their way through this. They manage this disease. Millions are living in long-term sobriety. We're going to tell you a story about how that's possible. We like to do this periodically on Recovery Radio. We're sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. We have more about them straight ahead. On the telephone with us is David Gillespie. David is, David, you know, welcome to the show, first of all. I forgot to ask you prior to coming on the air here, how long have you been sober?
Thanks, Steve. I've been sober for 3.5 years, a little over 3.5, and I'll be 4, God willing, in November.
Good for you. Congratulations. Well, so anyway, I find that, you know, these stories of substance abuse and then recovery and sobriety very powerful. So, you know, thank you for sharing yours with us. So tell us about yourself. You know, where are you from? How old are you? Where'd you grow up?
So I was originally born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Shortly, like I would say like a year and a half old and 2 years old, I moved to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and that's where I grew up and lived most of my life until, you know, I ended up changing my life and getting sober. You know, my father was an alcoholic who, you know, died an untimely death directly related to alcoholism. He actually, prior to me being born, had 13 years sober in the program, was doing really well, and you know, somewhere along the way he ended up picking up a drink again and never made it back to the other side of things.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of that is that I have like this wonderful, loving mother who's, you know, completely unselfish, compassionate, caring, and just like the exactly what I try and be in recovery is who she is, like, naturally as a person, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I grew up in Lancaster, you know, maybe 20 minutes from the retreat, and I went to school there, graduated high school there, worked for, like, a local grocery store and all that stuff, and, yeah, you know.
How old are you, David? How old are you?
24. I'll be 25 in November.
You know, a little bit later we'll get into what it's like to be sober as a young man. It's a particularly... probably tough deal, but we'll get into that a little bit. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a half sister who, like, I didn't grow up with or anything, but, you know, as a result of being sober and everything like that, we're a lot closer now than we've ever been. She has 3 kids, and, you know, I try and stay as involved as possible in her life. She visits down here fairly often, like 2 or 3 times a year, and we always get together now. So,
mm-hmm.
As a result of being sober, we're pretty close.
How long ago did your dad pass away?
I was 15, so we're looking at...
almost 10 years ago.
Nine years ago, yeah.
But you were aware then that he had a drinking problem and he was now sober. You were aware of all that?
Well, I was aware of that, not during that. Like, I never saw my father draw, like, a sober breath my entire life growing up. After his death and, you know, my attempts at sobriety and everything and recovery, you know, my mother exposed more of that to me and explained that when she met my father, he was, you know, sober for a decade and stayed sober for, you know, 13 years prior to taking that drink and going back out and never recovering again. So that was like an eye-opening experience to me later on down the road. But as far as during his life and my time with him, I never saw him. Sober.
Yeah. No.
Except for like a 2-week period where he was hospitalized for almost a month in a coma. And then when he got out of the hospital, he stopped drinking for 2 years until he picked up a drink again on my birthday.
Do you ever have the occasion to ask him why after being sober for so long, he picked up a drink again? Did he ever explain that to you?
Well, I never got like a full explanation. But what I, you know, what I've come to understand in you know, as I've matured, is that he suffered from multiple sclerosis as well. And I think, you know, through being on Social Security, losing his job, being unable to work, you know, physically deteriorating, never being able to be the father he wanted. You know, it's very difficult for somebody with multiple sclerosis to even go in the backyard and throw a baseball once it progresses to a certain point. And he missed out on a lot of those things, missed out on providing, you know, certain things for his family. And I think that in turn made him so depressed that, like, he never really put in another fight to give up.
Yeah, I understand. So you know, tell me,
life getting better as a result.
Yeah.
Even though he had experienced that in the past.
Yeah. So tell me about your experience with the substance abuse. How did it start? What were the circumstances?
So, I mean, I got exposed to it. Like, I can remember my first drink clear as day. At 12 years old, I drank with a couple of my buddies. They were also the same age. We went to his parents when I sleep. We passed a bottle of Bacardi 151 around, like just a water bottle for the three of us as kids. And I remember the effect it had on them, and I remember the effect it had on me. Both of them fell asleep fairly early, and for me it was different. You know, it created something in me where I was, you know, I knew that feeling produced. I went over and I drank with his older brother and his friends, like, for the remainder of the night, and I knew that that feeling I felt when I woke up the next day, the feeling from the night prior, was something I wanted to recreate as frequently, as often, and as much as I could after that.
That was a conscious thought in your head that you liked this and you were going to do it again.
Oh yeah, no doubt in my mind. It brought me to, like, that calm, cool place inside of myself where, you know, the world quieted down. My head stopped. You know, my thoughts stopped racing. My head stopped spinning, and it was something that I knew I wanted from there on out.
Were you an unhappy kid prior to this? Were you anxious? Were you characterize yourself before that?
It's funny because, like, you look back at it now, you know, over a decade later, or and you know, almost 4 years sober, I look at it and I could say now that, like, yes, I was an anxious kid. Yes, I was different, or, you know, whatever that feeling is. But, like, at that time, I didn't know that those were the things I was experiencing. At the time, my life was the only normal one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that everybody else felt that way, and I couldn't figure out why everybody else didn't want to experiment with drinking and then make it a constant in their life, or, you know, whatever substance it was at that point. But at that point in my life, it was drinking, and it relieved this feeling of, you know, needing to be accepted, this fear of the unknown, you know, this worry about what was yesterday, and all these sorts of things that were going on in my head that were abnormal, but at the time it was the only experience I ever had, so I didn't know that they were abnormal.
Yeah. The other thing people don't appreciate about this disease is that the people who have it, and they're honest about it, will tell you that they abused substances because they liked it.
Yeah. No, and that's the only, you know, after all the, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on therapy, you know, at the end of the day, for me, and I know, you know, I know there's tons of people that that have different reasons, but for me, Steve, I was never running from anything. Nothing ever super traumatic happened. As much as you would think, you know, my father dying at 15 years old would have been like this overly traumatic event, it was almost a release to me because of the alcoholic life he lived and the thing that I put into my family dynamic. I never drank because I felt saddened or depressed or was running from something. I drank because I liked the effect that it produced inside of me.
Yeah.
And the way it made me feel. It made me feel good, and I sought that with every fiber of my being.
Yeah.
You know, well, it wasn't ever to run from anything.
It's important to hear that because, again, props up or it substantiates the disease model of this. I mean, this is a sickness that just tragically makes you think you're getting better when you're getting worse, and it's its own justification.
Elusive.
Yeah. So you began with alcohol, and where did you progress to?
Oh man, I mean, I stuck with alcohol for a while. It was a really, really super good friend to me for a long time, and I liked the feeling it gave me. It was social. It would, you know, help me forget. And it really got me to, like, the place I wanted to be. I would say I stuck with that for maybe like 5 or 6 years. And, you know, it kept causing a lot of problems with me. You know, the police become very invasive when you're drinking under the age of 21, and they make it very difficult to do the things that you want to do. And, you know, I get underage drinking, I get DUIs, and eventually, like, I come to the realization that I'm never going to be able to drink and not drive, or I'm never going to be able to drink and not get in trouble, so I might as well just hold off till I'm 21. And, you know, throughout this whole time, I experimented with everything, ecstasy, cocaine, you know, narcotic pills, just about everything but, like, heroin, crack, and crystal meth. To this point in my life, I had tried everything, and nothing really tickled my fancy the way that alcohol did. You know, of course, you know, a little bit of coke to keep me up or whatever the case was, some ecstasy to have fun on the weekends. But then through, like, you know, my DUI and, like, my third underage or something like that, I came to that realization that I was going to get in trouble, so I better just wait until I'm 21 instead of stopping altogether, you know, realizing that this is a problem in and of itself, but I think everything else is a problem in it. And I switch over to these pills that I'm selling, and I remember saying to myself, I'm never going to be like these people. And at this point, Oxycontin was, you know, very, very prevalent. And I end up, you know, sniffing. I say, I'm just going to do a couple of these on the weekends. And, you know, that lasted for like a weekend.
When you say you were never going to be like these people, you meant the people you were selling the Oxycontin to?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another common fallacy that people with substance abuse problems, they look at everybody else and they go, well, I won't get that bad.
I'll never be calling people at 2 a.m. asking, can they give me one for tomorrow and I'll pay them back, or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, but of course you did wind up that guy, right?
Oh, absolutely. I said I was only going to do them on the weekends, and that lasted about a weekend.
Our guest on the phone is David Galeski. He has struggled with alcohol and drugs for a very long period of time. He's now 3.5 years sober, and he's taking us through that journey. We have more with David straight ahead on Recovery Radio. Stick around. Welcome back. Our guest on the telephone is David Galeski. David has joined us to talk about his struggles with drugs and alcohol. He's 24 years old, and he's sober now 3.5 years. David, so to pick up where we left off, you rapidly go through the whole medicine cabinet of stuff to abuse. These things. Tell me about that.
I remember at the time, you know, Oxycontin was just getting converted to, like, the hard pill you couldn't break down anymore. And my town was really affected by Opanas at the time, which were, like, Oxycontin morphones, and they were twice as strong, and you know, you only needed a little bit in the beginning, and it just progressed from there to needing, you know, from needing 10 milligrams to, before I knew it, 120 milligrams a day, taking some Xanax and some Klonopin with it. And I'd say that lasted for 6, 7, maybe 8 months, and something that I said I was only going to do on the weekends. And, you know, I slowly draw out of life just completely. I remember, you know, withdrawing from college at that point, just to simply drive around, sell as many pills as I could so I could do as many as I wanted to. And now mixing benzos and opiates together, and it's just a nightmare. And I end up in my first treatment center, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's up north in Pennsylvania. It's on a mountain and everything. And I get there, and I get out of detox finally after being the sickest I've ever been, you know, from now until then. And I get out of detox, and I go up to this group, and there's a gentleman there, and he comes out, and he's holding his pillowcase, and I could still remember this to this day. I could tell you what they were wearing, where they were from, and everything like that. And he holds up his pillowcase, and he points out another man, and he actually accuses the man of wiping his butt with the other man's pillowcase. And I sat in that treatment center for 30 more days or 28 more days or whatever the case was. And I said, from that moment forward, when I walked into that group, that I'm nothing like these people. Therefore, I don't have to do what they have to do in order to stay sober. I just caught a bad habit. And as long as I'm not sick anymore, I won't catch a habit again, and I'll be able to use the way I want it to use. And I get out of that treatment center, and I already have something set up for when I get home. And, you know, little to my knowledge, I spend, you know, a month away, and, And now these pills are going off the market, and they're getting harder to find and everything like that. And you can't crush them anymore. And now everybody's doing Roxy's, and I don't really like those. And so I get one of the last pills in town, one of the last Opanas in town. And then the next day, you know, I have no other choice to get some heroin. And it's much cheaper, easier, and affordable. I said, well, I'll never put it in a needle. I'm just thinking of what's different from that in a pill anyways. And from there, I would say I sniffed it for about a week, and somebody put in a needle, and it changed my whole life. I can't believe that I had been wasting money doing it the other way for as long as I had, and I never turned back from that.
With that first intravenous use of heroin, did you think you'd finally found the answer to whatever was bothering you?
To be honest, Steve, I don't know, man. I just remember being really, really high and really, really liking it.
Yeah, really liking it, right?
Yeah, and at that point in my life, for time sensitivity, I didn't have to explain like the emotional bottoms and the harm that I caused to everybody in between. But I had been arrested a couple times. I had, you know, lost many relationships with not only girlfriends but friends, and my mother and I are not getting along, and it's basically the main beacon of my family at that point, like as far as everything I have, that like I'm already at a pretty low point. So I don't know what I was looking for. I know that I wasn't looking for freedom anymore, like I wasn't going to find it in a drug, but I was looking for relief from all these stressors and all these things that I've lost and all this guilt and shame that I would feel on a daily basis because I become so disgusted with myself. So I wouldn't say putting it in a needle was what I found, but I found that it was the most effective way to give me a little bit of relief for that day, that point in my life.
It's again, an amazing and horrifying aspect of the disease of addiction in that it convinces you that in spite of the fact it's causing all this destruction, it's the only thing that can relieve it.
Yeah. Exactly, and that's like kind of how it keeps you in there for so long, because now you found something that gives you immediate gratification, right? And I always talk about it like this: is that you know there was a point in my life where using drugs and alcohol was just fun, and then there was a point in my life where it shifted to fun with some problems, and then it shifted even to fun with problems, not some problems, but just a lot of problems, but still some fun. And then it shifted over to problems with some fun. And then eventually it just became all problems, right? And I don't know, the switch was very rapid, and I don't really know, I couldn't pinpoint exactly where it was, but I know that it happened gradually, but when I look back at it in hindsight, it was a complete rapid switch.
Yeah.
Like it was the best time of my life to the worst time of my life.
I mean, there comes a point, it seems, where you become the disease, right? The only way to define yourself is that you are an addict, right?
Sure. I live for nothing else.
David Gillespie is our guest. David is 24 years old. He's 3.5 years sober now, and he's sharing his story, a remarkable one, of recovery, and not an easy one at that. When we come back, we'll find out just how often David found himself in treatment. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. We have more. Welcome back, everybody. Recovery Radio, sponsored each week by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, facilities now West Palm Beach in Florida and in Lancaster County. Let me give you their phone number and tell you why I'm giving you the phone number. On your refrigerator, you probably have these magnets for police and fire and maybe poison something. And they're up there and you never want to use them. But they're there if you need them. I give you this phone number in the same spirit. We hope you never have to call a treatment facility. But if you do, trust me, you could do no better than Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. But they want you to have the number. You can call them about any questions you have about the disease of addiction and what they can provide for you. 855-859-8808. 855-859-8808. Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Our guest, David Gillespie, knows a little bit about Retreat and what they do. We're discussing his struggles, and they were titanic, I dare say, with substance abuse. And now he's celebrating 3.5 years of sobriety. David's 24 years old. So you know, now you're just, you are this disease, you are addicted to very bad stuff, and you've already been to one rehab. I know that your history of treatment is an up and down kind of situation. How many times have you been in and out of treatment?
Like in total, about 11 times.
11 times. Was each trip a residential situation where you spent weeks at the facilities?
Yeah, at least 9 of them. Towards the end, you know, it became hard to get certed for that much time. You know, I couldn't do, I guess I wasn't following through on like an aftercare plan or whatever the case was. I would just continue to use. And my insurance company saw me as a liability.
Yep.
So I definitely know how that goes. But I would say, you know, average was, you know, 21 to 28 days, 30 days, yeah.
Yeah, detoxed every time?
Yeah. Oh, my. I would never make it to treatment unless I required a detox.
So,
one of those people who would stay out till it got bad enough.
Yeah. So how do you keep getting up off the floor and going back into treatment? What motivated you each time?
Well, I'm sure it was different each time, but you know, a lot of times it was external motivators. I'm a white kid from the suburbs who doesn't like living out homeless in the wintertime. You know, I'm sick of seeing that terrible look on my mother's face of disgust and remorse. And the only way I know how to make it better is to go back again. And then there was those times where, like, I really wanted it. And this is going to throw people for a curveball who don't understand the disease of addiction. I believe that every time an addict goes to treatment or something like that, that at some point in their recovery that they want it, right? And I believe that one time you cross that threshold where you don't want to get high anymore, but you do it anyways. And for me, like, that happened. Like, I would leave treatment sometimes with my head hung high, and wanting to get sober and really wanting to go out there and stay sober. And whether I wouldn't get involved in a program quick enough or, you know, I would have this terrible feeling of anxiety and worry and fear and guilt and remorse. And the only way I knew how to quiet those voices in my head was to go use. Didn't change the fact that I wanted to be sober. What I was doing to stay sober and what I wanted were two different things.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's an interesting point that people, again, who really don't understand what's going on with this disease need to get their heads around. That when someone has multiple trips into treatment, it can look like a failure from...
Sure.
To someone from the outside. But in fact, you're trying to reconcile those two things.
God forbid, if you send your loved one to a treatment center for 30 days and they've been struggling with addiction for over a decade or even if they were struggling for 2 years or whatever the case may be, and you think that problem is going to get resolved in 30 days, that's not the aim with treatment. The aim is that they discover the tools they need while in treatment and to recover outside of treatment, you know, and treatment really bridges that gap.
Yeah, we mentioned earlier that your description of the progressions, you know, of using drugs, you know, use drugs and it's fun, and then you use drugs and it's less fun and more problems, till you get to the point where you just are the disease.
Sure.
When treatment starts to work for you, is there a time when you have to start thinking of yourself as something beyond an addict? Do you know what I mean? You've defined yourself by this disease for a very long time. During treatment, do they impress upon you that there's other ways to look at yourself than someone who's addicted to drugs?
Sure. I mean, they do a ton of, you know, self-esteem building exercises and in clinical therapy and everything like that. And you know, that stuff works for me, but it works for a lot of people. But for me, when I go back into my room at the end of the night and I'm with myself, by myself, talking to myself or left, you know, with myself, I don't necessarily feel that way. And for me, like, my beliefs had to be grounded in something bigger than me. And I found my solution in, you know, AA, I found my solution in the 12 steps. I found my solution to God bigger than myself.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until I found that solution, I worked towards it, that I began to view myself as something different. And hopefully, you know, what it really played into me is viewing myself as something different was the ability to help somebody else. You know,
mm-hmm.
is that all my shortcomings, all my failures, all my depression and worry and fear and all these things I went through and all these bottoms I hit, because there was always one lower, could be a benefit to somebody else along the way, you know?
Yeah, it's hard for you.
That was a game changer for me.
Sure. It's hard for you to hear stories of people's struggles and not go, well, here's my story. I was in and out of rehab 11 times. I understand.
Absolutely.
Well, there's another, the other thing that people need to get their heads around, and I'd like you to comment on this, is that, as you said, it's not 28 days into a treatment facility and everything's okay. This is a process, isn't it?
Sure. Absolutely. You know, it's a process that doesn't take days off. It doesn't take the weekends off. It doesn't take 20 minutes off throughout the day for a lunch break. It's an entire concept and a way to live. And that while you may discover the things you need to discover in a treatment center in order to get that train set in motion, as far as practical application of doing it is going to come outside of there. So yes, I can practice, you know, what I need to recover from addiction in a 28-day or in a 30-day program. But the reality of it is I'm restricted with no drugs. I'm told when to get up. I'm told when lights out is. I'm told when to go to this group. My day is mapped out for me. And those things are things I absolutely needed in the beginning. But then I get out and I'm like, okay, what do I do now? And I think if you really, you know, put your nose to the dirt and grind through and get processed some of the things, you know, with a good clinician, and you really stay in that regimented schedule, that you can adopt the tools for recovery that you need outside of there.
David,
really start applying them in your daily life.
Let's talk about applying them, particularly in the early stages of sobriety. Now, you're a young guy. That's already a certain difficult situation in the world we live in, to go out and try to be a young man in this culture and this our society where alcohol is glorified and drugs are widely available. And early sobriety is a difficult time. What was it like for you to try to establish yourself in those early days of getting sober?
I mean, there's, you know, we just talked about being in and out of treatment 11 times, and I think the benefit of that was that every time I learned something new of where I could fall short, what I could get away with and what I couldn't get away with. And I look at some of the people that I got sober with this time, and it may have been their first, maybe their second time in treatment, and their first or second time trying to get sober, and they had a lot less leeway than I did. And what I mean by that is that I knew that I had a very short, tight rope to walk with as far as what I could get away with and in acting out, whether it was with females or gambling or slacking off in my meetings or slacking off and talking to my sponsor and all those sorts of things. For me, this time around, I knew I had to walk that line very, very closely. There wasn't a lot of wiggle room for a guy like me because I had, you know, relapsed so many times and got loaded so many times after getting X amount of days sober or whatever that, you know, I stayed away from females big time. I would say I really didn't even interact with any of them for 90 days. And maybe, you know, casual conversation or whatever. But I would go to my therapy that I was required to go to. I would go to a noon meeting if I didn't have therapy. And then I would go to a meeting at night and I would call my sponsor. And if my sponsor said, hey, we're meeting this day to go over this step, there was nothing in the world that was going to stop me from getting there.
You know, what's interesting about the characterization is that for the long, while you're in active addiction, you're constantly telling yourself a bunch of lies. I won't do this, or I'll only do it this much, or I'm not like them. Then you reach this point where you realize you have no, as you say, no wiggle room, and there is no margin of error now. You've got to stop lying to yourself, right?
For sure. Absolutely. You know, and there's so many different ways, you know, I believe that we're all on this like sort of spiritual axiom, right? And especially if you're an addict in recovery, and like the fact of the matter is like that I have to, and it says, you know, the 12 steps says, you know, as a result we try to carry this message to addicts and practice these principles in all of our affairs. Well, I believe like practicing those principles in all of your affairs, whether it's with the opposite sex, whether it's with what I'm doing with my time, whether it's with my career or my job choice, whether it's with my significant other or, you know, interaction that I have with people, that I need to stay focused on what is best and what does my higher power want me to do. What's the most honest, unselfish, caring, and loving thing that I can do that day for somebody else?
Yeah, as you know now, because you've been, you know, in the trenches for a long time, a lot of people hear that stuff about higher power, and they think religion, and it scares them away. What would you say to them?
Well, I use the word God because it's simply the most simplistic one for me, and I think that the fact of the matter is that you're complaining about God or a higher power or religion or whatever the case, or spirituality or whatever the case may be, but the fact of the matter is that your life is so unsatisfactory when you're out there, and that the reality of it is that you would rob Peter to pay Paul in order to continue with your addiction, and you want to talk to me about where I place my values and morals is absolutely absurd.
A waste of time. David Gillespie, our guest, will come back with David and sort of catch up on where he is now after 3.5 years of sobriety. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We want to thank David Gillespie for joining us. It's terrific that folks are willing to come on the air and be so honest about their struggles with drugs or alcohol. David's a 24-year-old guy, battled mightily against his disease of addiction, 11 trips in and out of rehab, successfully applying what he learned at Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, and the result is now 3.5 years of sobriety. Where are you now? Where are you now?
I live in Florida, so you know, I eventually, after one of the trips to Retreat, they sent me to an extended care all-mail program in Florida. So I've been down here for the bulk of my sobriety, minus about 11 days that I spent up there. So since I got sober 11 days before I turned 21, and I've lived in South Florida ever since.
And tell me about you're married now, or you have children now, or what's the situation?
So, you know, oddly enough, I got engaged in the beginning of June. I actually asked my fiance to marry me on a trip back to New York, where she's from, and asked her in front of her family and in front of our house and everything like that. So it was a good, you know, great experience. I have one daughter. Her name is Nora. She was born October 14th of 2015. Mm-hmm. So she'll be 2 in October.
Now, you mentioned earlier that during your battles with the disease and your stints in and out of rehab, it was important for you to avoid emotional entanglements with women. As you got sober, that changed, or, you know, tell me about your personal, the extent the relationships was interfering, or the addiction was interfering with that.
Oh, vice versa, I guess. If you asked someone that I was in a relationship with, they would say my addiction was interfering, and I would say that they were interfering with my addiction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so what I found in the beginning of sobriety, right, is that I do some inventory, I take a real good look at myself, and I start to build my life around positive things for the first time. I find out, like, what I want in this world, and, you know, when I start to become those things, I attract those things, right? And I find somebody that does the same thing similarly to me, has the same characteristics that I want in a woman, which, you know, is unselfish, caring, loving, honest. And as I become those things, I'm finally able to attract those things for the first time in my life, right? And it takes work, right? And of course, you know, I found my fiance, you know, in recovery. Mm-hmm. I asked her to speak at a hospital and institutions meeting for me, and from there we got coffee a couple times, and I became really attracted to the person she was and the person she had found herself as in recovery. And I would say the same for me, or the same for her about me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And tell me about the baby. How has that changed things for, you know?
Drastically. I mean, I was like Captain Recovery, man. I was making 6-7 meetings a week, sponsoring 10 guys at a time, And, you know, what the principles that I, or the affairs that I had to practice my principles in weren't really there outside of recovery. Like, I worked a job waiting tables, and I was just all about recovery, right? And then God puts like a wrench in that plan, and now I'm responsible for another human being's life. And I'm 22 years old, almost 20. I was 22 for a month when my daughter was born. I turned 23 the next month, and I have no idea what I'm doing, right? And all I know is this little human being, who has brought out a level of love in me that I've never felt before or never even knew existed. It's like it was like a parallel, dimension inside of me, that I found the second she was born. And now I know that this little thing is completely and utterly dependent upon me and is completely defenseless. And without me, really doesn't have a chance for success, of course, with her mother either. And now it's my job to build this little person up to be the most successful she can be before she goes out to conquer the world on her own, right?
Yeah, it sounds like a good plan.
and it's just given me an entirely new sense of responsibility, drive, ambition in my life, and there's nothing I want to be more successful at than being her father, right?
Right.
And it's truly a beautiful experience. And without being sober, without being in recovery, without God affording me that prior to this, I can't say where I would be. You know, would I have even been capable to be a father? Would this state even have allowed me to live in the same home as my daughter? You know, and have being, you know, sober for almost 2 years right before my daughter was born, like 20 days, my daughter was born 20 days before I would have had 2 years sober. It gave me the opportunity to be the best father that I could be, right?
David, terrific.
Grateful for.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much. Continued success. 3.5 years sober. It's been a hell of a battle, but good for you.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks for joining us. Everybody, enjoy the rest of your weekend, and look for us on Saturdays, Recovery Radio. Take care. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.